exist in the prior bill, and those elements deal with victims' rights. One, the right of the victim to testify at sentencing, and the right of the victim to appear before the parole board. Those were added because at the time we were drafting it, we feared that this might be the only appropriate vehicle. There is another vehicle in the House that has those provisions in it. We would ask you simply to concentrate on the merger and consecutive sentencing issue and not concern yourselves with the victim's rights elements of this particular bill. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, thanks. Mr. Jones, come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Charles Jones, a member of the Board of Parole. My testimony will be rather brief here. I'll naturally, of course, respond to any questions that might be posed. House Bill 257 will, first of all, require an additional staff person simply to coordinate the disclosure requirements of the material available to the board, and additionally ensure that the 30-day statutory time requirement is followed. Now, of course, I'm speaking right now only to Section 7 of the bill. Another portion of the legislation that will have an impact and cause some concern is the ability of the victim and the district attorney to present evidence at the hearing if, in fact, that is the effort that is put forth. It appears that the board will be put in a position of retrying previously tried and adjudicated cases. A victim impact statement would seem just as appropriate. There may be also some due process questions as it relates to the inmate's need to defend himself against attempts at relitigating the facts without the benefit of counsel. Finally, and most importantly, the legislature mandated in 1977 that the board develop and follow guidelines for determining lengths of stay in prison, considering the severity of the crime and the offender's criminal history. This was accomplished through the formation by the legislature of the Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards, consisting, of course, of five circuit court judges, the parole board members, the legal counsel to the governor, and the administrator of the Corrections Division as an ex officio member. The task of developing guidelines was completed, and the board does carefully and scrupulously follow the guidelines. It is unclear to me what impact this legislation is intended to have on the board's ability to make objective decisions as required by the prior legislation. It is important that the committee understand that the board does receive correspondence from victims and does give serious weight to the impact of crime in our communities. As an aside, a board member was burglarized recently with a substantial loss, and my point here is simply to relate that board members are not immune to becoming victims. As proposed, we oppose this legislation and would encourage continued input from the victims of crime and the prosecutor. Now, we also have opposed the House version of this on the same grounds, and that is simply because we don't know what the objective is, and nobody can state. I think victims appearing at the board hearing have a heightened expectation of what might happen when in fact it might not. And I think this particular portion in the bill, for what it is worth, is simply a sounding brass and a tinkling cymbal. Or as Shakespeare, whoever might put it, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, because we've already been told what we have to do. And I wouldn't want a victim to come in thinking that the statements that they make changes the findings of the court and some other result will accrue.
Mr. Chair, do you have to notify the district attorney now before you parole someone?
Yes, statute requires that.
So, as I recall, it seems like we went through this bill last session and we had some variation on, I don't know if they appeared personally or they had, but what the victims were saying is that one of their concerns was not to relitigate the case because that had been done, but they were concerned, for example, that the person might be put back into their very community again and they wouldn't know about it and they feared retaliation or that the person would harm them. And they were concerned more about where they were going to be placed, what kind of supervision they were going to have, that kind of thing.
Senator Hendrickson, that's kind of beyond our control. First of all, Oregon doesn't have any statute that speaks to banishment. You can't tell a person they can't go back.
Well, no.
Now, the notification process is not the board.
Can I just ask you a question?
Sure.
Don't you have any authority under the terms and condition of parole of saying to where they're going to live when they go out?
No.
So, in other words...
No, we have no right of banishment.
Choose to reside in a certain city, or that they can't choose to reside right next door to the victim or something like that?
I would suppose good common sense on the part of the parolee would say that. But we cannot define that.
You can't
contain
the
geographic. We have been told that we can't tell people where they can live. Or we can't banish them from a community in which they have their support system. It just doesn't work to banish a person from Grants Pass and says you cannot live in Grants Pass, you've got to live in Portland. Now, I think legislation might be considered that does that. I think it would be subjected to a constitutional question. But to go further, there is a notified provision, though.
They have to be in Portland.
There is a notified provision, and that individual can notify the corrections division, which does the supervision in this matter, to be notified when that individual is released.
It is through the corrections division. A victim, Mr. Chalmers, Mr. President, can request the corrections division. Do they make the request to you originally, or do they make it to the corrections division? Can they do it ahead of time so they know?
Now, our requirements...
Can you tell me a little bit about your understanding of how it works?
Our requirements of notification, are to the sentencing judge, prosecuting attorney, and the sheriff of the county of conviction. Victim notification is the responsibility of the corrections division. They file the notifies. The notifies become a part of the institution file, and the notifications require a 60-day notification prior to the release date.
So if I wanted to be notified, I put my name in with the correction division,
would,
and they'll let me know 60
The superintendent of the institution would be notified that you want to know when this individual is released and where he is going to be released to. Yes.
Okay, any further questions, Mr. Jones? All right, thanks, Mr. Jones.
I had an adjunct, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and I merely want to say that I support the position taken by Mr. Sandrock in that it is simply clear to me that when we sail out on the sea of merger, nobody has any idea where we're going to dock this thing. And additionally, as it relates to the consecutive sentencing, it would be most appropriate if we were able to have circumstances where the findings are made on the record as to the reason for the consecutive sentence application. And that is because the disparity that results from consecutive sentences without any type of systematic approach produces ridiculous results. I had a case the other day, 5 cases of theft in the first degree, conviction on all, consecutive sentences on all, and a 2.5-year minimum on each one. Now, that is totally ridiculous, and I don't particularly get upset if the judiciary doesn't like that, because that kind of result is terrible, especially when we have the next case that has 5 convictions for the same thing, and they all concur. And the only thing we can do is aggravate to the maximum to bring some equity into it. So I think there needs to be some efforts made to formalize, if you will, the reasons why consecutive sentences are imposed. And I remind you again, as Mr. Sandrock did, when they seem to be totally ridiculous, we have the right to unstack. And we do, but we then incur the wrath of the judge who imposed them. And we would choose to eliminate that possibility whenever possible. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
a refresher. When you want stack, is that unanimous or it's 4-1?
4 out of 5.
Four, yeah, so it has to be 4-4. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. All right, Jane Aiken.
I think we did that in 81. Yeah, it used to be an end. But try to. I didn't think that whole thing got through.
Thank you for the record, Senator. My name's Jane Aiken. I'm legal counsel with the Governor's Advisory Committee on Drunk Driving. We've heard most of the arguments so far, so I'll attempt to be brief. the Governor's Advisory Committee on Drunk Driving is concerned with the issues addressed by Mr. Sandrock concerning multiple sentences in the event where you have a drunk driver who kills or injures multiple victims, and we feel it's important to have that authority available to the judge to have, number one, multiple convictions, and two, if necessary, an appropriate consecutive sentences. Subsection 7 that was addressed by Mr. Jones indicated he felt that at this time the victim impact statements were adequate. I might also note to the committee, I'm a former prosecutor for 4 years. I've dealt with a number of crime victims, and could indicate to you, at least in the case of one criminally negligent homicide, it was too soon, at least in the point of view of the victim after the death of her son, to adequately express in the victim impact statement the extent and feelings with respect to appropriate treatment and sentencing. And we did, through the district attorney's office, help prepare statements that were submitted to the parole board. We do believe it's appropriate in some of those cases to have the victims have the opportunity to be heard to express those feelings to the parole board. And I've worked during the last about 2 years with a group called Crime Victims United, and they too have expressed in a number of different types of criminal offenses where the time at sentencing is sometimes far too soon for a grieving victim or victim's family to adequately express themselves, and that the opportunity to be heard at the parole board would be an important factor for them.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I can understand from a therapeutic psychological sense how it's probably helpful, but if they do that and then the parole board leaves the person out or something anyway because they really, you know, they have this matrix and things, do you think that the crime victims are going to feel worse? I mean, if they have an expectation that as a result of their sharing their feelings that perhaps a different outcome will occur?
I don't believe so, Senator Hendrickson. The group that I worked with included some of the parents of murdered children, parents whose children had been killed or injured by drunk drivers, and that's not the concern that was expressed to me. The groups they've worked with, in one of the chapters, Compassionate Friends, talks about a grieving process that sometimes takes a long period of time before the families can actually deal with those and express those feelings and express those to the parole board or to anyone else. And so they feel at least to have that opportunity at a time when they can be more rational to explain exactly what the impact has been is not only therapeutic but also to bring the personalized attention to the parole board. I might also comment that at least in the one case that I handled regarding a drunk driving fatal accident, the victim's family had requested to be notified by the parole board and by the corrections division when that person was released, because that person had a reputation, had multiple DUI convictions, and they did not receive that notice. Ran into the lady on the day, I believe the day before Thanksgiving, just a few months after she'd been incarcerated. And she was on a release at that time. She had not been paroled, but that was quite shocking to the family to have that and not having received a notice. And I'll note that when that was brought to my attention, I checked with the Sheriff's Department, and they had received a notice about 24 to 48 hours after she'd been released. They received the teletype saying that she was due to be released. So the notification process is not necessarily adequate at this time, and so there are some concerns under subsection 7 that would address the victim's needs and wants to be heard.
Mr.
Senator,
I just need to ask you one more time, what is the expectation of an appearance at the parole board? Do you expect that the parole board's decision would be altered by that appearance? Because if we are asking them to make a decision based on the matrix in comparison with the other kinds of folks there and behavior in the prison, I need to know what we're driving at, if we are in fact getting involved in the whole sentencing question at that level. I need to know what your expectation is other than therapeutic. What is the expectation?
Senator Cohen, I believe, at least in addressing that issue from what the victims have told me, the idea hopefully is to create a more complete record, perhaps to explain what may not have been covered in the pre-sentence investigation from the victim impact statement or from what happened.
To add information to the existing record so that the parole board would in fact make changes at that point in time based on added information.
Correct, and that doesn't necessarily change in terms of the range that the parole board is dealing with, but in terms of whether to set it high or low or where the release date may be more appropriate. In the particular case that I can recall, the pre-sentence investigation did not have set out all of the facts that we believe adequately.
So the intention really is to change the sentence at that point.
Not to change sentence, the sentence, but
change. To change the rate, to change the sentence. Yeah.
All right.
I have the answer. Thank you. To change the sentence.
I need a lawyer if that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, to change.
So they can't change the sentence because they've been sentenced. The range of. Oh wow. That's the
correct.
Time.
The range the parole board is dealing with as far as when to set the release date itself.
Okay. But they get a range. Excuse me. But they get a range when they first come in.
Under the statutes, I believe the parole board meets with the inmate within the first 6 months to set the release date. We're talking about at that hearing, giving the victim the opportunity to be heard when the parole board is making that decision as to when to set the release date.
Okay. Yes, Senator,
does the inmate have an attorney at this first meeting of the parole board?
Under the statute, as I understand it, the inmate has the opportunity to have anyone present with it. It could be an attorney, it could be someone who's not an attorney.
The state doesn't furnish one attorney, though.
I don't have the answer for that, Senator. They have a right to have, under the statute, it can be another person can be with, but it doesn't have to be an attorney.
Yeah, I don't think that under existing practices, the state has an obligation to provide indigents with attorneys in those hearings. That's my understanding of the system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
My point, Mr. Chair, was that if they didn't in that hearing, then there would probably be no necessity in the release hearing.
Well, I would see a distinction, though. It seems to me that if...
Well, the difference being that both of them would possibly affect the time he spends incarcerated.
Yeah. Except they're relating the facts, if you'd like the victim to come up and talk about the facts.
You know, approval's not on the record. It's presumably the record that, you know, the sentencing judge had and that kind of thing. New witnesses at a parole hearing would be extrinsic to the record, and I suggest that might raise some rights on the part of these inmates to counsel if it's going to affect how long they're going to remain there. Seems to me it would. I know. Okay, Steve Jacobson. Let me see now. Is Bill Gary still on? Oh yeah, Bill. Did you want to sit down? Sit down, Steve. Did you want to testify?
Yes,
I did. Who else wants to testify? All right, we've got two witnesses left. Now, I've been sitting here since 5 o'clock. Straight.
Concurrent sentences on committees.
I want you to observe in the record to note that the senator who thinks that the chairman doesn't have enough to do and that he should get committee help in setting the agenda of this committee left an hour ago. The same senator that gave me a 48-hour notice because he didn't think that I was capable of setting the agenda myself. And look at the kind of work that this committee's got and who's not here. All right, proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Jacobson. I'm an attorney with the Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland. I was also on the steering committee of Oregonians for Individual Rights, which was the committee which ran the statewide campaign against ballot measure 8 in the recent general election. I mention that because all the provisions of this bill are basically things that were in that ballot measure. I want to deal quickly with the things that can be quickly dealt with, things that we're generally in favor of and support, and briefly Section 2, which provides for the victim's right to appear at sentencing, which can certainly happen now, but this replace in statute we've never had any problem with, and we support. I don't see any problem with making that provision of law. In dealing with this in the House, on House Bill 2594, you should know that there was a fiscal impact statement done on that, which had some startling figures in it. But both the DAs and myself agreed that was simply wrong.
We're used to that happening.
With regard to the section you were just dealing with, which is Section 4 of this bill, dealing with the victim's right to appear at the parole board, our position during the campaign and now is that basically this is an idea that we're not opposed to. I think it's something that has therapeutic value, as has been mentioned, that victims feel a need to be part of the system all the way along. I don't see anything wrong with that. And I think it should be encouraged if it can be accommodated. In the House, I proposed some amendments to here to deal with problems that the committee was just dealing with, namely the right of the prisoner at that point to have an attorney if there's an attorney involved from the other side.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If the victim shows up without an attorney, do you think it should be handled like a small claims court, in other words, where there's no lawyers involved?
That was basically my provision. I said that if the victim appears, I left the general language in, but if the district attorney, this provides for the district attorney to appear from the committing county, which mm-hmm. has some drawbacks. If that were to be the case, or if they bring their own counsel, which this also provides for, then I think that not only constitutionally is it mandated to have a defense attorney appointed and there, but it just makes some sense in terms of fairness.
Do you think there'd be any constitutional problem if it was just the victim themselves without a lawyer appearing, that there'd be any constitutional issue if the sentence was lengthened as a result of just the victim without assistance of the district attorney talking with the parole board?
I don't think so. I can't say for sure that I'm right on that. I didn't think so enough to put that into my amendment, so mm-hmm. I'd have to stick with that opinion. There will be a number of impacts that Mr. Jones has already dealt with, some of them, and that there may be raised hopes, there may be problems with that, us telling victims that things are going to happen that simply aren't going to happen. I think that if people in the system are sensitive to that, perhaps that can be avoided. To address one of Senator Cohen's concerns about the notification process, I proposed an amendment to ORS 144.260 to be made part of this in the House bill, and I believe I've been gone out of town for 2 weeks, but I'm told that it's been accepted as an amendment. That is the notification statute that presently provides that the Corrections Division notify those various people, the sentencing judge, the district attorney, the sheriff, and arresting agency. And I think you could, as part of this, if you're going to do this, have the victim notified of the person's release. The problem with that approach is that the person will go on pre-release before they're paroled. All this requires is notification of release on parole. People are coming out 6 months earlier than that. If you really want to address notification, you'll need to address your concerns to the Corrections Division, not the Parole Board, and that will have to be done by a separate statute. And I think that can be done. The other amendments that I had offered in the House and I believe have been accepted dealt with treating the prisoner on an equal footing with the district attorney and the victim, giving them access to the same materials, which was, I think, inadvertently not accomplished by the wording that was used. If I can't tell whether the District Attorney's Association wants this now as part of this bill or wants it deleted, if it is to remain part of this bill, then I would be happy to provide this committee with the amendments that have been made on the House side. I don't know where that bill is going to go on the House side, but I'll stay in touch with legal counsel as to whether or not those things are decided. With regard to the anti-merger or merger issues, it's difficult to summarize one's position with regard to this.
Well, summarize, though, I'm going to have to have Mr. Gray up here at 5 minutes to eight, and he's only going to have 5 minutes.
I think that the thing that I hear most often is, first of all, the horror story of the Garcia case. And I personally don't have disagreement with the people who are telling you that case shouldn't have been decided that way, or at least justice demands a different result. However, if you want to overrule the Garcia case, what you can do is do as they've done in one small section of the proposed bill, you overrule it. What they have done in the rest of the bill, I'm afraid, will create a horror story of potential litigation by attempting to correct problems that will affect both multiple victim cases from the same act, one victim case from the same act, and all those various combinations of things by trying to create the possibility of multiple sentences because, for Mr. Garcia, they've created some problems that are going to be felt all the way down the line. This will overrule standard case law that has been in effect for years with regard to the burglary theft situation. Now, if a person breaks into a house intending to commit theft, they can only be convicted of the burglary, which I submit makes sense, because that's what makes the breaking and entering a burglary rather than a criminal trespass. This would change that for seemingly no good reason. The multiple victim cases, while it might make sense when there's multiple victims who are injured, physically injured, to always make sure that you can consecutively sentence, and I think that is the case now, what this would do would create the same possibility for property crimes. As Chairman Fry pointed out, in a theft case, where a person walks over someplace, picks up a handful of pencils, right now, if those pencils happen to belong to five different people, that person might be able to be charged with five different crimes, but they're going to be merged. You're not going to say that that person is guilty of five different thefts and can be sentenced separately and consecutively for five different thefts. Under this bill, they could. There's some distinctions that have to be drawn that I don't believe have been drawn by this
Mr.
bill.
Chair, I thought there was something in here about property interests that would preclude that.
The problem with that is that they addressed one issue that apparently sometime it came up. They addressed the problem of joint ownership. You steal one thing and it's jointly owned, that will be one. But it doesn't deal with the problem of if you pick
up a cluster of things
or you drive a car away and it has several people's belongings in it. It just doesn't make sense if the belongings happen to belong to five different people to convict that person of five different crimes, whereas they happen to belong to one person to convict them of one crime. Well, maybe we've come a long way with this. I don't think we're really close to there yet. I think I'll just cut off my comments at that point because it's just such a complicated thing. I realize there's been one effort before to deal with it in interim. I think that's a more appropriate way to do it, to have a committee that really looks at it over long term and gets some more scholarship involved with looking at the effects of what...
You've crushed Peter Sandrock.
He's not scared. Okay, I'll close my comments with that and submit the written comments at a later
time. I take it from what you've said, you and prosecutors are just too far apart to get together on this subject matter.
I don't know.
I'd say this is the closest they've been. This issue has been here ever since I've been here, and this is the closest I've seen them, actually, I think.
Maybe making progress, but I just...
If they would say that the Garcia case and the Lopez case in this case is really what we want to change, then I think we could probably make decisions on it. But the way that the changes, they're going about the change, I just think is the wrong way, by trying to set a rule that then is going to have the effect of changing everything else, whereas the courts have really come to some very logical conclusions about what to do with these.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
How do you feel about eliminating the judge's discretion on consecutive sentencing?
Well, I think there was a misstatement to the committee that, first of all, that the judge doesn't have to state reasons now. That's incorrect. The judge must state reasons. If attorneys don't object, if the judge just sentences and they walk away, then it won't happen.
Mr. Jones testified to us that they don't have that.
I'm sure that happens, that the reasons aren't there because the attorneys didn't say, please state the reasons for the record. But if any attorney wants the judge to state reasons for the record, they are mandated to do it. And if a case can be reversed on appeal,
but
just because...
Is there a criteria that they have to make the finding?
The criteria are case-made law. And they're still developing.
Okay,
this is an attempt to...
How do you feel about this criteria?
I feel about the first criteria, 4A, that it's generally trying to get at the right thing. However, the wording, an indication of defendant's willingness to commit more than one criminal offense, which appears at the bottom of page 1, mm-hmm. is unfortunate wording. I just don't have the faintest idea what that means. It seems to me that whenever somebody is in the course of conduct and they're committing crimes that can be divided into several things, that they're always indicating a willingness to do that. So it seems to be meaningless language. The problem is that they've correctly stated a concept that comes from case law, in that it's conduct which is not merely an incidental violation of a separate statutory provision in the course of, and that's something that we can get a hold of and deal with. But then they set it off against this other phrase. It would only make sense if the one phrase did not overlap with the other phrase, but it simply does, and it ends up making no sense.
Okay, thanks. All right, you're great. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I just say I would wish they would work on that language, or that the witness would work on some of that language.
Yes.
Do you think it's a good
point? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Gary, Deputy Attorney General. Department of Justice supports this bill. I have submitted written testimony which to a large extent overlaps with comments that Mr. Sandrock made, and I won't repeat myself given the lateness of the hour. Let me state a couple of general principles.